Zarita Malik. Zarita is a lecturer in media and communications at Brunel University. Her recent publications include From Multicultural Programming to Diasporic Television in Media History and Doing Multicultural London, the Case of King of the Ghetto, which appeared in Journal of British Cinema and Television. She also edited a special issue of South Asian popular culture on called The Cinema Issue, and her book Representing Black Britain, Black and Asian Images on Television appeared in 2000. Zarita.
Thank you. So a complete shift in gear, in fact. We're going to be talking about television and talking about the UK context as well. And I want to talk really about British television in relation to racialised regimes of representation, focusing on a reality television show, fly-on-the-wall observational documentary called The Gurrawals. Now, this was screened on Channel 4, which is Britain's fourth public service broadcasting channel, in 2009 in a 9 p.m. peak time slot. And it's part of a broader series called The Family, which traces the everyday, apparently mundane, lives of ordinary Britons. Now, I want to approach this reality series from a critical perspective, using Paul Gilroy's convivial culture as a frame and as a means to understand recent manifestations in ethnic minority television representation, particularly in the reality genre. Now, I want to argue that far from being a reality text based on aspects of the documentary form around notions of unmediation, actuality, and truth, in fact, it's the social comedy taxonomy that is a prerequisite for the making of this particular documentary production. Although the reality genre is usefully treated as what Casey has called a generic hybrid, I suggest that this comedic construction actually facilitates a conventionalised and caricatured modality of British Asianness, which has lent itself especially well to the crossover appeal and commodification of South Asian popular culture. So what materialises in the Gurrawals is a mediated convivial culture accommodated by the elasticity of the reality genre, thus producing a certain kind of cultural catharsis by both putting the same people, South Asians, in the same situation, comedy, and also obscuring the real vexed politics of difference in broader society. So I'm principally concerned with what the Gurrawals is symptomatic of, and we'll refer mainly here to the circuits of meaning and interpretation mediated by public debate. Now, you can see from the quotes here that the series was highly acclaimed by critics. Channel 4's head of diversity, Una King, has described it as a seminal moment in the diversity history of ethnic minority representation. And the main success of the series has been attributed to the family's authenticity, comedy gold interactions, and universality. In 2010, the series was nominated for a prestigious BAFTA award for its in its factual series category. Now, the overwhelmingly positive journalistic and audience response converges on its emotional, historical, and social significance. As Charlotte Brunston says, judgments are being made all the time, so let's talk about them. Robin Nelson, who has also addressed the question of quality television, has argued that when value assertions are made, it's always worth asking, what is the discursive position? Now, such confident endorsements, focused as they are on the realism of the series, support the truth-based claims of even those documentary forms that combine factual information with entertainment values, described as post-documentary by Corner, Hill, and Palmer. They also pertain to one of the dominant arguments in studies of the reality genre, which run alongside those around governmentality, that the genre has opened up diversity, or what Brunston's called pluraling up. In After Empire, Paul Gilroy presents his utopian vision of conviviality as a new way of living with difference. Stuart Hall has cited the ability to live with difference without eating the other as one of the major tasks of our time. The Family offers us a display of Britain's social diversity. The first series was a white British family, the Hughes family. The second series that we're discussing today, the Gurrawals, is a British Asian family. The third series is a British Nigerian family, and there's rumours that the fourth will be a British Jewish family. So TV is deeply implicated here in the construction of what the national family constitutes. As Homi Bhabha tells us, the way a nation sees itself and projects itself is tied to the narratives it tells itself. This imagined community, to use Anderson's term, is multiracial, culturally distinct, but shares universalist values. Gilroy argues that cosmopolitanism has been damaged by a neo-imperial agenda in Britain, and there are now signs that a more vulgar or demotic turn has the potential to replace it. So these new popular modes of cultural practices are important because they actually open up convivial spaces and the potential for an inclusive kind of national citizenship for ordinary people in a multicultural democracy. So there's two dimensions of interest here. The first is unpacking some of these debates around the series and the quality of the series and questioning whether actually it really can be determined as seminal. And the other is exploring how these popular modes of conviviality have been accommodated by public service broadcasters because of the troubled context that they currently find themselves in. So here we have the Garhwal family. They're a Jut Sikh family living in a five-bedroom pebble-dashed house under the Heathrow flight path in Windsor. In the summer of 2009, 28 cameras, 37 microphones, several miles of cabling, and a production crew in the back garden were set up to film the family. With over 1,000 hours of footage, the editing stage was, of course, a significant part of the post-production process and for the creative presentation of reality. Arvindran Sarjit had an arranged marriage and have been together for 35 years. Their eldest son, Sonny, is a BMW-loving Heathrow Airport security officer who aspires to be a film director. His fiancée, Shay, is a recruitment consultant in the city whose family have shunned her because they disapprove of Sonny's different caste. Then there's daughter, Kaki, and husband, Jeet, pregnant with their second child. And finally, youngest son, Tindy, a 23-year-old graduate who appears to sleep all day and party all night. Arvindran Sarjit's sparring is a primary aspect of the series. It's triggered by his blatant sexism. Some famous lines from him: I want a cup of tea, give me the food, I ask for jam on this, silly fool, you're snoring like a pig, and of course the seminal, I couldn't go on Big Brother, who would cook for me? These all fuel the comedic overtones of the series. Brett Mills, in his study of the sitcom, tells us that the heteronormativity of social comedy typically renders women the routine objects of humour. Gender conflict is based around such personal squabbles, not related to broader hierarchical gender structures. Whilst Arvinda's sexism is the axis around which much of the comedy operates and simultaneously reinforces culturalist assumptions about Asian family life, it also appears to be the effective response from viewers, produce effective responses from viewers and from critics. The Garhwal family's authenticity is reaffirmed by their civilian ordinariness rather than celebrity ordinariness. This can be addressed in relation to the assumed democratising impetus of the documentary form. Early forms of social documentary were geared towards what Stuart Hall has termed the democratisation of the subject. Recent forms of documentary in the reality genre mode have seen the increasing visibility of the ordinary person in the media, a turn to what Graham Turner has called the demotic. With the broad-based participation underpinning the reality genre, there's a question of whether the turn to the demotic has also enabled a type of social democracy, an assumption which appears to underpin the consensus around the Garhwals. Rather, I want to agree with Penzorn that post-documentary forms demonstrate a shift from traditional documentary values, for example, social democracy, towards diversion and playful entertainment, from public and social issues to individual private concerns, and moreover, a shift from cognitive to effective responses from audiences. Following Turner, I also want to refute the proposition that the demotic turn, which the Garhwals is a fascinating example of, necessarily carries with it a democratising politics. Turner argues, diversity is not of itself intrinsically democratic, irrespective of how it is generated or by whom. Instead, the Garhwals, vis-à-vis a range of production mechanisms of the reality television genre, is utilised to promote an impression of diversity and equality. Democracy is nothing more here than a much-needed social purpose within the context that I'm foregrounding. Convivial culture is co-opted, packaged and reoriented to deliver this in the style of an as-if construction, to use Scannell's term. What's missing in the public accounts of the Gurrawals is a distinction between representation with regards to access and visibility on the one hand, what might be termed demotic, and representation in terms of textual, discursive and ultimately ideological framing, that is, its democratising potential. Television's focus on the family underscores the emphasis on the private, personal and domestic, according to Baresi and Nunn. The family is a key motif in screen representation. Sue Holmes tells us that series such as Sylvania Waters and Craig Gilbert's An American Family are examples of observational documentaries' domestic gaze. Stratton and Anne have noted television's spectacularisation of the nuclear family. Underpinning the critical acclaims of the Gurrawals is that it transgresses pre-existing stereotypes in order to produce a sense of collective social values. We're told frequently in comments that this is a family just like ours. So a shift from the particular to the universal. But since stereotypes are the primary device through which representations of race circulate in media texts, it's also also necessary to acknowledge how stereotypes function as a representational practice. So what is it about the Gurrawals that has secured it as groundbreaking, regardless of whether one considers it to have challenged or reproduced stereotypes? And these two different reviews demonstrate exactly that, one arguing that actually the series challenges stereotypes, and the other saying, well, no, it's absolutely dependent on them, but that's what makes it brilliant. The positioning of ethnic minorities in the reality genre is relatively straightforward. Because it passes itself off as reasonably unscripted compared with non-reality or narrative television, it largely escapes major accusations of misrepresentation, lack of authenticity, or negative stereotyping, criticisms that television producers have long wrestled with. This makes the inclusion of ethnic minorities less politically charged, exempt from the burden of representation debates, and contained in reliable, safe formats. The family situation has, however, been one of the defining tropes through which South Asian communities have been represented in media discourse, as bound by traditional and patriarchal frameworks, and also the basis of comedy melodrama, if we think about particularly British Asian cinema, from My Beautiful Laundrette to Bend It Like Beckham, Bargy on the Beach, East is East, and most recently West is West, all depend on this familial situation. So the Gurrawals provides a particularly watchable frame of reference which produces an interaction between two interdependent and necessary genre dimensions, what Luders calls conventions and expectations. The conventions of the form and substance of comedy, overlaid here with the expectations of how South Asians have typically been positioned within popular culture. If the Gurrawals is counter-hegemonic in some ways, and it is, it does rest on culturalist assumptions in others. But any concern is offset by the hybrid comedy and reality generic frameworks through which the series is constituted. For all the emphasis on universality in public debates around the series, it simply would not have worked in the same way outside of the framework of the South Asian popular. Now, these are viewers' comments on the series, revealing some quite interesting perspectives on the series. So let me have a read of those. Now, these opinions that the Gurrawals was just not what I was expecting and has been tampered with stand out as rare occasions when viewers articulate value assertions based on the formal elements and production techniques, the social construction, rather than on the authenticity of the family itself. The Gurrawals draws on formal codes of the sketch show and situation drama. Mills tells us that the sitcom is criticised for its simplistic use of stereotypes, outmoded representations and failure to engage with social or political developments. It's fundamentally conservative, an aspect upheld by its stable form. At work here is also what Hamamoto, in his analysis of nervous laughter, has described as repression, or further, a form that is repressively commercial. By positioning the Gurrawals as a source of comedic convivial pleasure, the series reveals a tension between ideas of authenticity and performance, the dynamic between what Calvert calls mediated voyeurism and mediated exhibitionism is especially applicable because the family members are already conscious of themselves as performers, in fact, being semi-professional theatre practitioners in real life. They were discovered, believe it or not, by a television producer in a West London arts centre where I used to work, where Jeet, a former Bollywood actor, was performing. All of this threatens to bring to the fore the major quandary of performativity in the reality text. What happens when the ordinary person plays up to the camera? Are we in danger, as Paul Watson, who made the original The Family series on the BBC in 1974, are we in danger of getting performances? The epistemological concern raised by Watson does not appear to produce a dilemma for the audiences of this series. If the Gurwells depends on pre-production techniques of non-democratic participant selection, then so does it on achieving post-production techniques designed to match the success of proven TV hits, such as the BBC Asian-led sketch show Goodness Gracious Me, which had crossed over to an 85% white viewing audience. Interestingly, the politically astute and omniscient cultural politics of Goodness Gracious Me centred on an implicit self-awareness of popular perceptions of British Asians. Similarly, the Gurwells appears to solicit extra diegetic knowledge through bilingualism and Asian cultural references, code switching and linguistic play. I'm arguing that convivial culture has arisen in highly salient contexts. So in pulling together some of what the Gurwells is symptomatic of, I want to argue that there are at least three important dimensions here. The first is the altering socio-political context of mediated multiculturalism. As Europe's streets become more culturally diverse, we've witnessed since the late 1990s a critical shift against the idea of multiculturalism. The media, and especially the right-wing press, has played a formative role in developing and mainstreaming this post-multiculturalist mood, with a circuit of headline stories based around homegrown terrorists, asylum seekers, the clash of civilizations, and most of all, the war on terror. In 2011, the UK Prime Minister David Cameron criticised the doctrine of state multiculturalism. What this vexed politics of difference suggests is that whilst public service broadcasters, for reasons that I'm about to describe, are strategically platforming diversity and difference, primarily through reality formats, the European political landscape is engaged in a neoliberal politics that is open to the idea that there's no payoff from an apparent engagement of political debate, for example, ideological concerns around better representation, into structural questions of redistribution in the economic sphere. In the same moment the political discourse retracts from multiculturalism in policy making, it is being utilised by the public service broadcasters as a source of public value. In public service broadcasting, we can find a depoliticised multiculturalism strategised as an institutionalised mainstreaming of diversity. It's important to know that Channel 4, that aired the series, was launched in 1982 with a brief to innovate and cater for minority interests. After a certain period of confusion about its strategic direction, Channel 4 now finds itself under extreme pressure. Its current public service drive is strategically entwined with its renewed diversity emphasis, which arguably sits at the heart of a public service ethos in which public value is determined. The problem of the ethical dimension for the public service broadcasters are currently being managed alongside a range of real economic requirements where the broadcasters need the protection of public money. This is also an environment in which, as delocalisation develops, the national public service broadcasters exhibit themselves as a form of social glue that produces the ideological pursuits of common culture and national unity. Through their investment in satellite and cable outlets beyond the national frameworks, ethnic minority audiences, and especially British Asians, have altered their response to public service broadcasting as a form of media governance, intensifying the challenge even further for public service broadcasters. So in this moment of unsettled negotiation between the media and the public, reality television has been purposely used by the broadcasters as a credible solution. The evolution of the reality genre has been a turning point in this fraught relationship, helping the overall look of public service television be more pluralistic and multiculturalised. the hypervisibility of multicultural societies against the backdrop of post-multiculturalism that we're experiencing has produced an interesting dynamic between on and off-screen contexts. As Emily Drew says in her article entitled Pretending to be Post-Racial, an analysis of the spectacularisation of race in CBS's Survivor, most reality television deploys strategies of colour blindness and post-racial politics in which race and racism are not explicitly addressed, yet often run as undercurrents shaping production and content. Ethnic contrast also provides a twist in the genre, cutting through the otherwise formulaic textual approaches such as the predictable narrative pattern of dilemma, transition and transformation. So the Gurrawals appears to help fulfil various seemingly contradictory social functions for audiences and broadcasters, compelling reasons perhaps for the series' success. One of the characteristics of convivial culture, according to Gilroy, is that it positions itself as racism-free. It comes as some relief, then, that this family, cast to be representative of lived reality, never talk about structural inequalities or social issues of race that occur outside of the Indian community, thus helping produce a sense of post-racial catharsis, because they symbolise an unproblematic and thriving cultural pluralism. In the face of its conservatism and apparent lack of requirement for radical reformism, the reality genre can help renormalise our understanding of cultural difference and therefore act as fundamentally conformist, maintaining social order. This reality series also facilitates a sense of stability in a complex society in which the very idea of cultural difference is being problematised in the public domain. The social function of democracy and cultural pluralism that reality television appear to deliver requires, I'm arguing, deeper probing. The shifting rhetorical value of convivial culture, itself a social construct, means that processes of commodification, incorporation and identification are all involved in how these culturalist discourses are mobilised and subsequently become institutionalised. This complicates the way we understand and receive such ordinary representations. Gilroy argues, because race ought, according to the tenets of liberalism, to be nothing, it is prematurely pronounced to be of no consequence whatsoever. Convivial culture is capable of generating such emancipatory interruptions, to use Gilroy's term. But he cautions that these are superficially integrated, but that's not to say that racism has been dealt with. And I want to add that this is demotic, not democratic. So to conclude, The Gurrawals requires being approached as a contested and ambivalent text implicated in the struggle to produce mainstream discourses of diversity. It's important in how we begin to evaluate what an ethnically diverse media representation needs to do today in order to be determined of value. Thank you.